Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Martin here, Electronically Yours as always. Today's guest is somebody who I crossed paths with in the early 80s, who was most famous for working with Martin Rushent in Genetic Studios on loads and loads of amazing stuff, including the Human League's Dare. And he's a bit of a legendary figure. He is a fantastic producer in his own right. He's worked with, most famously, with The Cure, Sisters of Mercy, Depeche Mode, Named Cherry, The Damned, Altered Images, Dexys, Go-Go's, Teardrop Explodes, Hazel O'Connor. I mean, loads and loads and loads of stuff. Very interesting. And obviously extremely adept at electronic music programming and production, amongst his other skills as a rock producer. He is the amazing David M. Allen. So let's start at the beginning. You, where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Southwest London. So I had a bit of a kind of star-crossed childhood. My dad played football for Manchester United and Queen's Park Rangers. Yeah. And
you played for the first team.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's all a bit of a dark history because his name was Reg Allen. And he basically had a mental breakdown.
Oh, no.
So the first season that Man U won the league, which was 51-52, he was the goalkeeper. Now, we all know goalkeepers are crazy.
Yep.
But he had a mental breakdown. So pretty shortly after I was born, I ended up living in the south of England instead of in Manchester with my mum as a single parent, because in those days, that's kind of the way it went. So I kind of grew up south of the river, but always had this kind of other, more glamorous aspect, if you like.
Right.
And of course, the links between football and pop music are enormous.
Well, I'm an enormous football fan myself, so I know. I've made several football records, actually.
Yeah. I have too, for my sins.
Have you?
I just mean the kind of link between people like, you know, like Rod Stewart not really kind of being good enough for Fulham, or, you know, there's a whole bunch of people who get injured at 16 and then discover cigarettes and music.
Yeah.
And also the thing about going out in front of all those people and having to perform for an hour and a half.
Yeah. Or in the case of Sheffield Wednesday, players not performing for an hour and a half. Yeah. Anyway.
Who were responsible for teaching the Basques to play football?
What, Sheffield Wednesday?
Oh, actually, I don't know.
No.
It's United, maybe United. Which is the one that's got the kind of red and black strip?
Yeah, that's United. We don't like saying that word.
Yeah. Well, Sheffield. All right, we're sorry.
Yeah. There are only two teams in Sheffield.
Well, they donated
their Sheffield Wednesday reserves, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Atletico Bilbao have got the same shirts.
That's
the same colours, because the Sheffield boys went over there to teach them how to smelt steel.
Isn't that amazing? Well, incredible. Mm. Okay, let's start with you were in a punk band, weren't you? What was it?
Yeah,
called? They were called
Pinpoint.
Pinpoint.
Yeah,
and
we
so
were sort of like
What appealed to you about punk? I know it's an obvious question, but...
Well, I've always thought the kind of basic definition of punk was that you have a right to do. No one has a right to like, you don't have a right to be liked.
Yes.
But you do have a right to stand on stage and go, well, here's my little song and here's my little bad feelings that I've got about this or that or the other. If everybody spits on you and throws cans, well, that's their right too.
Yeah.
I didn't have any musical background whatsoever, really. So basically the schools I went to didn't do music. I went to secondary modern, where we basically were taught metalwork, woodwork, basket weaving, you know, that was like pretty much two thirds of the curriculum, because none of us were supposed to sort of go to university or do anything like that. So the first time I ever encountered people who played musical, I mean, I was a fan of music and I had a tape recorder from the age of nine that someone had given me, you know, those usual funny things where somebody in your childhood gives you something and it eventually, years later, that is where you think, oh, that I went on that path then. The idea of playing an instrument or being a musician was never in my kind of ken. And we never did it at school, so there wasn't even really that to kind of like fall back on. So it wasn't until I went to university, because I did manage to survive secondary modern and do that, that I met anybody who played instruments or even sort of thought, oh, maybe I could do that. And I was always massively crap in comparison to all the people I knew who could, you know, quite manfully knock off kind of ragtime songs on guitar or, you know, AC/DC songs or whatever. And punk was the big kind of opener, I think.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that I mean, I've done 150 of these interviews now, and I would say, I know it's ridiculous. I would say that a good 20% of them have got a story, a backstory that's similar to yours. Not musically trained.
Yeah.
Often from a troubled upbringing.
Mm.
Not always, but often. In the UK, anyway. And a lot of people, I'm trying to think who was the best example, it sounds almost identical to your story, were given tape recorders at a very early stage.
Oh, yeah.
Used it as a creative tool.
I am a cliche.
No. It's just interesting because it just shows the power of technologies. It enables people to be creative
and
people find their way through it, right? Bless you that you are here. You actually made it and have done incredible work throughout your career. And it just shows that a lot of young people nowadays find it overwhelming to think that they could have a career, you know, of a similar stature to yours and mine. But did we?
Well, it looks like that from the wrong end of the telescope, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, at the start, you know, when you're looking at it the other way, when you start, you haven't got a career, have you? And at some point, you've got a career, but you're not even usually kind of aware that you've got one, because really, frankly, you're thinking, oh my God, I finished this album next week and I haven't got anything in the pipeline. How am I going to work? Which is the same for actors, authors, play, you know, the entire creative gamut until you've actually made it, I suppose. And by the time you've made it, you've pretty much passed it. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so.
It's kind of less true in America, because in America they're less ageist, and it's seems to me from the outside, you seem to get props. If you're Bruce Swedenborg and you did, you'll work till you die because you did some massive album 30 years ago, that's just not true in the UK.
Yeah.
If anything, it counts against you, possibly quite rightly.
Yeah. So obviously we've... Our paths have crossed in the early 80s as you were working at Genetic Studios with Martin Russian, and that was your big break, I suppose. And
I guess it was, yeah. I think I like to think of it as his big break.
Yeah, go on.
Well, they're doing a Martin Russian compilation and I'm on two-thirds of it, so... You know, because one of my things is it's kind of about teams. It's always about teams.
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't matter how much people go on about Prince, there's always that lady engineer that he had for many, many years. Well, I'm sorry, that's the glue that keeps the mortar, the bricks together, the mortar, you know, and that's important. But people like to have heroes and they like to say this person is a genius.
Yeah.
But like everybody walks around with clay feet, and, you know, when you work in production or you're, you know, a musician or, you know, all these sort of other kind of, you need a team of people.
I agree.
And
yeah.
So, yes, but that going back to Ginetti, I was looking at it last night because we cross over professionally with Billy McKenzie.
Yes.
And it was very interesting when I did the DNA of DMA album, or when I was doing the promo for it last year, I did Record Store Day, and they agreed for the first time ever to have like a talking head or somebody who wasn't, you know, a musician or an artist with an album to promote. And I did it with Phil Thornalley.
Right.
You know, who wrote Torn and was in The Cure for a while. And because he did all the recording for Love Cats and I did the mixing. And at this point, and through this dialogue that we had about this kind of very similar moment in time for us both, he was making the transition from working in Rack as a studio engineer stroke producer, where he started when he was 18, to becoming a composer and a songwriter.
Right.
And I was making the transition from being a band composer songwriter to being an engineer producer. And we met exactly at that crossing point.
Wow.
So we had a crossing point, which, and the fascinating thing was getting the backstory, each other's backstory, as to how that moment happened. And that was just like really brilliant. Like, because, like, I mean, I mixed Perhaps, for instance, which you produced.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not, did you co-write it with Billy? I mean,
No. He wrote it. I added to the arrangement quite a lot, but.
Yeah, exactly. So I sort of, you know, it's really always kind of quite interesting because now there's the kind of meeting of the two of us, which basically really happened intellectually in many ways, like, you know, Christ, when was it, 83 or 84?
Mm.
Last century.
That's right.
And,
Well, we are, our practices.
Mm.
And our taste in music are very similar, aren't they? You know, we were both there at the birth of sequencer-driven rock or pop or whatever you want to choose to call it.
Yeah.
And our histories would have been completely different had things like the MC8 not been invented. And, you know, obviously I'm a big System 100M person. I'm proud to say that in the Roland book, they brought out this big coffee table book, and
yeah,
the page of System 100 has got my face on it, so I'm happy with that.
Fabulous.
But the System 700, I always kind of thought, I can't afford that. And you got to play with
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah, who could?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there was a, I mean, the genesis of that was when I was in Pinpoint. We made a classic mistake. I say we, because obviously in those days you're managed and, you know, really what do you know about it? And really, are you very interested, particularly in how kind of careers are structured? But we had had a lot, basically the record company wanted to record everything that we'd written. Now, it didn't make any fucking sense, really. And really, we made a classic mistake. Instead of making a first album with someone like Vic Mayall, who did Ace of Spades, and then make a second album that was slightly more developed, even if it was a bit shit, and then a third album, which maybe might have been good, that classic pattern that now no longer exists. They wanted us to do everything, and I was frankly very bored with all the old songs, and I got Martin to agree to do experimental music.
Yeah.
Songs, and at one point he was going, well, what do you mean experimental? I mean, I'll go, well, what's that, pointing to the MC8 and the System 700, and he says, well, it's a System 700. He says, what's the System 700? I said, well, I want to use that.
Wow.
Which would would have been nice if I'd known what it was. Because to be honest, I kind of, it was like a massive calculator, but you know.
To get the best out of those things, it takes quite a lot of messing about and experimentation, is what I've discovered.
The funny thing is that because Martin's reputation was all for doing punk bands, guitar bands, he couldn't get arrested using that either. So, you know, at that point or just shortly before that point, he was giving people studio time like Ultravox, you know, with the Fade to Grey project, Visage. But he wasn't actually getting his hands on it himself. So I kind of facilitated him.
Right.
As an artist should do. An artist, you know, that's one of the things you kind of go, well, technically I'd like to do this. And the producer is someone who goes, oh, yeah, I can help you achieve what you want to achieve.
Exactly. Tell us about your relationship with Martin then. I mean, how do you, looking back on it now, how would you quantify it for people?
Well, kind of like for a long while, I just sort of thought, I mean, effectively, it did split the band up, I suppose. On the other hand, I wasn't very happy playing live. I didn't enjoy playing live, so kind of that probably wasn't for me. And it's fair to say, I think, for the first kind of year that I worked for Martin as a sort of an assistant, financially it was very precarious because he was building a big studio out in the middle of the country during a period of time where an SSL desk, which comes along a bit later, the SSL, you know, is like £350,000, and all the stuff is the same sort of cost. So kind of for the first year, I suppose it was me and you against the world, that type of feeling. Because we were kind of ploughing a furrow that we knew not many people were ploughing with the System 700, you know, trying to make this kind of music the same as yourselves were. And we did quite a lot of stuff that, like, we did a surf band from America. It was kind of almost the first thing that opened it up. Yeah, like called the Rabies. And then we did another guitar band, and we wanted to make this electronic music. And I did a solo single with him, which is on the DNA of DMA, The Sound of Music. And he'd done Home Safe.
Stop. Mm. I've just listened to The Sound of Music. I actually was listening to that entire album this morning. For people who don't know, it was a Record Store Day release that came out in 22, right? And essentially all your kind of songwriting, electronic pop, but it sounds so much like the precursor to Dare, a lot of it. I'm in particular, The Sound of Music, I actually put a note down saying this should have been a hit. So it's quite interesting.
Well, thank you. Well, it's funny, isn't it? You get to this kind of ancient age and then you do something like this, which is, you know, of historical interest really. And then people say things very kindly like you did then. And then you kind of think, well, really, did I go down the wrong route? You know, because effectively by going down the production route, I really cut off my artistic career completely. I never really wrote songs. I mean, I did have a big publishing debt because all the band debt got put onto me. And in fact, it took me like nearly 3 years to get out of my deal. By which point, you know, like by 1984, you know, can you imagine the thought of going back to kind of being, you know, a songwriter? There's too much water under the bridge. I was already on another career. I'd already made some records with The Cure and had like top fives with them in my own right. It would seem a bit stupid, but it does make you kind of think, oh, could have gone down that route.
We can still do it.
Maybe I'd be at the Shepherd's Bush, Empire tonight, you know.
Yeah, but you
trotting
can
out
still,
the old days.
You can still do it. Come on. I mean, we're still touring, and God knows, you know, we're like, we've had to draft in lots of younger people into the band just to lower the average age. But,
For what, for the insurance?
Yeah, well, for anything, just to keep us alive, I think. Okay, so let's move on to, I mean, the list of people that you've worked with is quite phenomenal, really. I mean, I knew you were very popular and you were busy, but I had no idea. I'm just going to run through a few of them here. So obviously you did 8 years with The Cure, right? You were their go-to man.
It's a bit longer than that, yeah.
Right. Sisters of
Mercy. Yeah, it's kind of 83 to 92, but there's bits, stribs and drabs of 93. But I did a web broadcast. I've done sort of bits and pieces. I edited the singles in late 99 with the head of the record company. And, you know, I still sort of had an association. But, you know, like a marriage, you know, once you've said everything to each other, then neither of you really wants to carry on, because not for any bad reason, but just from, you know, you've given to each other all the presents you can give.
Oh, that's such a beautiful way of putting it. I shall get onto the divorce lawyers immediately. Nana Cherry, who's a good mate of mine. You work with her, right?
Oh, yeah, love Nana. And Cam.
Great, isn't she?
Yeah.
So, and the Associates, of course. The Damned, who I've always been... They are my favourite punk band of all time, The Damned. They felt to me completely authentic in a way that I never fully bought into the whole Sex Pistols thing. It all seemed a bit too contrived for me and a bit too pub rock, whereas The Damned were a bit darker and a bit more real for me. What do you think?
Well, they're all originals. They're all completely cartoon originals. I mean, I do love The Pistols. It's a very kind of brief glimmer in the darkness, really, that one album. And of course, all the rumours about McLaren writing the lyrics, which is questionable, apart from what lyrics has Lydon written since that are the same acerbic penetration. The Clash, well, it was always kind of... I mean, Joe Strummer was a fantastic frontman, and the 101ers were great, and it's great, but it's kind of mired in rock and roll.
Yeah.
The Damned kind of are, you know, they're all their own people. I mean, Dave's absolutely the quintessential cool lead singer, and with the threads, Captain Sensible, what could you say? Scabies, the best drummer that came out of punk, unquestionably.
Wow.
And Brian James, the iconic monolithic kind of guitar hero sort of figure. Yeah. But yeah, and I love The Damned too, and I still do.
Great. And then the Wire.
That album that I did with The Damned, incidentally, we did at Connie Plank Studio.
Yes,
Germany.
Mentioned, yeah. So tell me about Connie Plank, because he's a kind of a fascinating figure in this entire history for me.
Hmm. Well, I bought basically. I did four or five albums, three albums maybe. Hang on, it's very kind of difficult to I don't know, two or three albums at Connie's back in the 80s and early 90s. Two with an artist called Gianna Nannini, who Connie had a massive hit with in Europe called Photo Romanza, because one of the things I think about doing craft work is we all know the effect that having a big hit record does for our careers. People come from all over the world to work with you. And I think when Connie, even though there was, you know, there's a big sort of tiny violin story in Connie Plank world about Kraftwerk not really giving him credit, and in fact sacking him after that album, even though he'd given them dead time at Cologne Radio and got the sack for it. Making that record, Autobahn, brought people like Devo, brought people like, you know, the Rhythmics. I mean, this, you know, it gathers a network of like-minded people that's global. And I was a massive fan, obviously, because all of us people of the certain age, we all liked Can, we all liked Kraftwerk, we all liked Amon Dool, we all liked the German krautrock scene. And And so I was a massive fan. So when I started working there, he had already was dead, but I loved the studio. It was so fucking unbelievably designed, well designed. The desk was fantastic, but the actual sort of acoustic environment there was amazing. And last summer I spent about a month. I've long wanted to write a kind of monograph on Connie's studio. And I got to 8 chapters last summer and then thought, fucking, I can't think of anything else to write now. Yeah. You know, once you've done the sonic environment, and I was going to basically interview some people and maybe try and flesh it out that way, more as a homage to the place. And then after Connie's wife died in, the studio was kind of mothballed and the desk came up for sale through a very random kind of series of events. I ended up buying it with a friend of mine called Mark Ralph, who's now got a famous kind of mixer producer in his own right. Does years and years and years, if you've heard of them. And
what was so the desk, I ended up with, by the way, sorry?
Well, basically, it's a custom built. They spent like Connie and a guy called Peter Lang and a guy called Michael Zahl spent like about 10 years, 12 years building this thing. It's essentially based on an MCI, but with lots of
MCI,
sort of...
I love MCI, by the way. Well,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, hot desks.
Yeah. So, I mean...
And it was during that...
It must have had lots of, obviously, loads of synths and... all that stuff. So, I mean, just flesh that out a bit for us, if you could. Describe the studio in shorthand.
In shorthand, well, basically, it's you have kind of you have different acoustic environments. So, the chapel is a good one.
Yeah.
Also, there's the kind of warehouse with a small ceiling down one. A low ceiling down one end and a high ceiling down the other end. So it's like a big flared rectangular space. And Connie's was L-shaped. The actual acoustic area was L-shaped.
Wow.
Which gives you like a very long throw. One room was this kind of, as I say, a flared rectangular shape, and the other was like a chapel. So those are the two basic environments that you like to work in. You were able to booth the entire spaces off with massive kind of screens. You could adapt it in the, acoustically any way you wanted. You had three exits from the control room, which was small. Because one of the things I think about control rooms is big control rooms are not very good for mixing.
Yeah.
Small control rooms are better for mixing. Big control rooms, it's nice to have a big control room so everybody can hang about and chat in the background while you're trying to work. That's a joke, by the way.
I know. I can relate.
The desk was amazing. The collection of microphones was amazing. The collection of synthesizers were amazing. They were often all firsts.
Wow.
So... it was just incredibly thought out. The studio itself is in an old stone. The farmhouse and the studio is in a stone circle.
Wow.
So, and when Killing Joke recorded there, I wanted to interview Jazz because when he was there, he kind of did all the ley lines for it, found the heel stone, which was all news to Connie and his wife, Krista. And now, interestingly enough, I'm not a big person for like natural light in studios. I don't really care about it. And in fact, don't really like it often, because I think one of the things about music is obviously you're biologically, you become much more attuned to sound when it's dark.
Yeah.
So low light's quite good for me. But this place, you sat at the desk, you had complete line of sight. It was properly done. So if someone was standing in the studio, you were at line of sight with them. You had a window on your right, a window behind you, and a window on your left. In the morning, the sun came on your right-hand side, At noon, it came from behind your head, and in the evening, it came from your left. So without having a clock, you knew kind of where it was. In other words, you know, you can go to places that have got natural light, but it doesn't really keep your bio clock in. But this sort of did, because it was almost like being outside, had a similar kind of vibe. And where you ate, just everything was perfect about it. Everything was kind of really well thought out. It was like sort of German hippies, but with a massive IQ and massive background in how to kind of treat people, you know. Like, for instance, Eno did music for airports there, the very first ambient record.
Right.
It's not the very first ambient record, obviously.
Yeah.
Because obviously if you go to Noi.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you can go to kind of Edgar Varese.
Oh, yes. I've done some cover versions of Edgar Varese's work. I did.
Have you? Wow.
Yeah, I did in 3D sound. Because, you know, we've got this 3D sound practice we've had for 20 years. And we did it in Ambisonics. We recreated Poème Électronique from the from the Brussels Pavilion in, was it 1958 or something, in the British Library foyer.
Wow.
Giant foyer.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome, I have to say. It was with a thing with Bowes and Wilkins that they were doing. They sponsored us. But anyway, you do realise that this is what you're talking about now is like the kind of synth geeks' wet dream. All this stuff. They're going to love this podcast. So you're saying they had lots of synthesizers, but I mean they must have had presumably a lot of modular stuff, yeah. And it was it all connected by CV and game?
I don't remember any modular stuff.
Really?
I mean, bearing in mind when I was there, I was doing electronic stuff. Well, I think, you know, it's like, well, I mean, presumably, if Connie was working with, when Connie was working with Kraftwerk, they brought their own equipment.
Oh, right, yeah.
It's easy to forget with people like Connie Plank that he did the Scorpions' first record.
Wow.
He did the Eurythmics. He did, you know, Vienna by Ultravox.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
I mean, the range of his work is, like, amazing. But it is that kind of thing where when you're a producer, somebody comes to you with an orchestra. For instance, if somebody came to you with an orchestral project that was basically going to be, let's say, two tenor singers and a 16-piece orchestra working with an arranger based on the, you would go, yes, I'm interested to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And if somebody came to you and they were a power trio, but they had some angle on it, and it was basically them, you know, like everybody was going to play Nashville tuned guitars, even the bass player, or some random thing like that, and the drum kit was going to be made out of, I don't know, recycled Sea Shepherd. you would kind of go, I'm quite interested in whether I can make something out of this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think what kind of the Connie studio was a sort of tabula rasa of that. So although he had bits and pieces, there wasn't like a massive, you know, there wasn't a massive guitar collection like there are in studios nowadays. There weren't loads. There was like one functional kind of, you know, like a telly.
Yeah.
There was probably a bass hanging around somewhere. There'd be a knockabout acoustic guitar, so you could kind of flesh that. There was a thumbtack piano in the rec room. There wasn't a lot of massive musician equipment.
Right, right. But the best microphones and preamps and all that.
For instance, you could reverse your van in up to the back doors of the studio. The studio was a converted barn. You could reverse the van up to that, open the studio doors and put your drum kit into the studio and then shut those doors and then van could go off. Now, there are studios where you can do that, but
not many. Yeah.
Not very many.
Interesting.
So even in that point of view, so fast get in, fast get out. He could get a band, come in, plonk them, have a sound in 2 hours, do an album in 2 days and then they could fuck off and he'd get another one in. That's probably how he did all the harmonious.
That's great.
Harmonious stuff. And
so this is funny. I'll let you have a sip of your tea. Hold on a sec. So, not funny. No, sorry. I'm talking about something else. You did one of the first 24-hour internet art galleries. Is that right?
Yeah.
So tell us about that. Yeah, I find that fascinating. What year was that for a start?
95.
Right.
1995. Now I look back on it, I think I was burned out or I needed a break. And instead of just taking a break and, you know, thinking about what I wanted to, because I'd been working since being in a band, you do a whole load of work there. That's like 24/7, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you're sort of living it. So from 76 through to 93, 94, I was just working all the time. And by 94, I was kind of a bit fucking burned out by it all, or needed a big break, you know.
Yeah.
And
I know that. I
discovered the internet. Well, obviously, lots of people discovered the internet. 94 was when the Mosaic browser came out. And I kind of sort of gradually got more and more. Like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? It's like, I don't want to, I want to get off the treadmill for a while. I didn't realize at the time that the moment you get off the treadmill, it's fucking impossible to get back on it again. You know, it's like you fall off the treadmill because you're broken. And one of the things I did, I sort of looked around for various things to do and I ended up buying a Pro Tools rig. When it was the first, you know, 16-channel one, an Avid video editor and a couple of other things, because I just thought the internet, CD-ROMs, interactive media, I just thought that was just all going to be much more massive than punk ever was or music ever was. I thought it was going to change everything. I thought it was another kind of new artistic frontier where new art forms would be developed, all this sort of crap like lots of people did. And then within a year of doing, I set up a company, and within a year of doing that, I was like having meetings with Tesco about shopping baskets. And that's when I realized it was just going to probably just corporate wank. And, but that gave me my first Pro Tools rig and set me down that kind of route. And one of the things I wanted to do to promo this or to promo it, one of the things about the internet is that, you know, you can look at art when it's at night.
Yes.
And you can do art when it's at night. So, for instance, in graphics terms, you can still carry on drawing because even when it's dark, you don't need light. There's a whole bunch of things that the internet did that were fundamentally different. And so I ran a 24-hour art gallery, which basically, because at that time you could download an image quite quickly. It wasn't much good for video. The MP3 thing still hadn't happened because MP3 on Avid video editors, MP3s were the de facto audio. It would convert the audio to that. That's when I discovered that MP3s were pretty good. So that was 94, 95. And I kind of did it as a promo. We were, what do you call it when people contribute to your thing, Patreon.
Crowdsourcing.
Well, our little crowdsourcer was Red Bull because that year was the launch of Red Bull in England.
Oh, they got money.
They just gave us loads of free Red Bull and we got PR from it.
Terrible. No. Cancel.
Well, instead, it was funny because, like, basically, I just refused to drink it because I read the contents and thought, fuck that, I'm not drinking that. Right. Bollocks to that. Everybody who was helping me on it all were quite happily drinking until they fell over at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And really interestingly, I had crates and crates of this stuff left over and I sold it all to Club Labyrinth in Dalston. Club Labyrinth was a sort of jungle club that was incidentally based on the inn, the same building that the Four Aces in Dalston, which was an old ska club, famous old ska club. So I sold it all to them, and
that's funny.
You know, to the early jungle rave scene.
I love that. Okay, another funny story. I think that this. I thought this was well. I need to know more about it. But you were employed to do a Frank Sinatra duets album, where he was singing over the telephone. Is that right?
No.
Oh, where? Well, that
was. I don't know where this story has come from.
It's on the internet. I blame the internet.
Yeah, well, it was great doing it because we'll keep this one going because it's legendary, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if I have recorded vocals on the phone from people, but not Frank.
So was that just a standard? You did work on it, though.
No, I don't know what that is.
So you've not had anything to do with it, no?
No, send me the link.
I will, yeah. I mean, how wild.
I'm going to do it because I might come back to you and in any comments on the postcard, I'll go, oh, shit. Or I'd completely forgotten about that. Because, you know, obviously, if it's, you know, one day in 1989 where someone asks you to do something and the technology never works.
Yeah.
One of the things. When I had my internet company, which was called Blank, which is far too ironic for the times, I had two ignition boxes put in. Now, ignition boxes were like ISDN lines, yeah. And you could do video conferencing. And so one of the things I thought, I had an office in Charlotte Street above the fiction offices, and one of the things I kind of thought about doing a business was of doing video conferencing like we're doing now.
Yeah.
But it took BT so long that I had no idea how much money it was going to cost me to do this.
Right.
And pretty much I lasted about a year before I had to go back and start doing record production because it was just, I was hemorrhaging money.
Yeah. You were burning through seed money, no doubt. Yeah.
Well, yeah, burning through seed money. And if you think that Bowie was like, you know, sold shares in himself in order to play in that world, you know, and I'm certainly wasn't as well capitalized as David Bowie. But a very interesting period in kind of time, really, because that was, you know, after a year, I realized that I hadn't found really anybody fun in the computing land to work with, anybody that I found amusing or interesting or fun. Then I kind of realized they were all geeks. Then I kind of realized the world really wasn't safe in their hands. Then I tried to, I was the bloke wandering around London record company offices going, MP3s are going to cut your fucking legs off. And no one likes a messenger, do they?
I went through a similar thing with, record companies, because I at one point in the early 2000s, I was I formed a company with a friend of mine. So I knew that record companies were making 5.1 mixes of everything as an insurance policy for the future
production. Yeah.
And I thought, but most of these things are just sitting on shelves and they're not getting released. Listen to this. I thought, I know, I'll get together, because I'm passionate about this, obviously. I'll get a company together. I'll call it Spatialized.com. To all the major record companies, because like you, I've got contacts with all of them, and say, look, for a small override, let's aggregate all these things together in one place. It'll be a central resource for anybody who loves this stuff. And of course, now we're in Dolby Atmos land and everybody's doing it. But then there was nobody doing that. And I thought it was a really good idea. But, you know, he went to these record companies and they just got no vision at all, none. You know, it's literally, and it's worse now, I think, it's all about just about
profit
and loss. Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, what it is it's one of these things very similar to the way that politicians, you know, the sort of round, for instance, for US politicians, it's, you know, a year and a half of doing something and then the rest of the time is trying to get re-elected.
Yeah.
And it's a very similar kind of thing, kind of in the music business, whatever exists of it now. You don't have a hit this year, you ain't got a job next year. So, you know, that's kind of, and it's always probably, it's always been tooth and claw. I mean, both of us have probably been through the same experience of going through a phase of really detesting A&R people. And for a long, long time, I've been in the phase of kind of, well, abject sympathy for most of them.
Yeah, I agree.
Because it's like they're passionate about music, many, many of them, passionate about the bands that they signed. Sometimes they'd sign a band, they'd develop them for a year, a hatchet man would come in, you know. And
it's the same in architecture. They call them value engineers. Value engineering, that's what the process is. Basically got these fantastic plans, and then at the end of the process, when they got like 12 million budget or something, the end of the process, they bring some twat in to go cut 25% off that budget. So that's why now the de facto procedure is all the new buildings that you see in London just look cheap, really. I think not all of them, but a lot of them do. They look very rubbish because these are the
It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because everything now that's built or made looks like it does in the computer.
Yes.
Now, because it can all be made by computers, they can now. So there's no human beings have built it. There's that aspect of it. So kind of everything does actually look like it was done on a CAD program.
And cars as
not,
well.
And yes, exactly, and cars. And obviously there isn't the money, because many of the buildings that we really absolutely go on about and love and all the rest of it, the old buildings, were all supported by the British Empire, and many of them were supported by the slave trade. And that doesn't really exist that way anymore. We're not an empire. I mean, obviously, it would be nice if the rather misguided people who seem to think that the country is safe in the Tories' hands, if they could be informed that somehow the British Empire was broken by the First World War and totally finished off by the Second, so there isn't a British Empire anymore and there never will be again, we'd be a lot better off.
Oh, absolutely. But also, I don't know, I'm pretty certain when you were at school, it was the same. I went to a grammar school in Sheffield. The only history we learned was the British Empire and the Tudors and a tiny bit of 20th century history, nothing about any other countries apart from America, and a little bit about India because that was part of the British Empire or was before. You know, I spent the rest of my life learning that there was a big world out there, and I'm sure
it's the same for everyone. Well, I mean, Irish history is different in Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland in schools. You know, world history is different in France. It's obvious, really, when you more you think about it. I've got a book called The Crusades Through Muslim Eyes.
Interesting.
I'm afraid the Crusades do not come out very well at all. In fact, it's a whole bunch of second sons who never had a chance to inherit anything. It's the same as America. America is a bunch of second sons who were never going to inherit anything in Britain, so just had to go somewhere else to, you know, make their fortune, much like whatever his name is, the red-headed guy who's married a coloured person and has to live in Canada.
Part
of the royal family. Will and Harry.
And Meghan.
Yeah. Well, he's had to go off to America to earn a fortune because of primogeniture. He's never going to be king. You know, and
we need to have our own radio station. This is hot stuff. And now we're going to throw this over to the listeners. Can you phone this number? Well,
yeah. Well, you know, with the Crusaders, it's like basically they all didn't have fuck all else because they were the second sons, so they all thought, well, fuck it, we'll go to Palestine and kill a load of people. And
that's very interesting stuff, actually. Well, this has been an absolute joy, I have to say, David. It's
yeah, lovely.
So lovely to have. Do you know,
IRL one day.
Yeah, but the irony of this, doing podcasts like this for me, is when am I ever going to get a quiet time to just, you know, chew the cud with like-minded people? You wouldn't, even in a pub, you're distracted by all the racket and everything. So
it's the only time it would ever happen in the studio is when something had stopped working.
Yeah. Or they're trying to do, they're spending half a day bouncing fucking vocals into a, you know, and all that stuff. Okay, so I finish all these, as you probably know, or you may not know, I don't know, with some stupid kind of smash hits questions. So what's your favourite film? One of them.
Christ. District 9.
It's a great film, isn't it? Beautiful. Have you been to South Africa, by the way?
No.
Yeah, it's a very interesting place.
Everything about District 9 is just absolutely a bit of genius.
Yeah.
Down to the aliens eating cat food. We all kind of know what it's about. The first reference to people eating cat food that I ever remember was Eldridge Cleaver, way back in the kind of 70s when I went to see Wilhelm Reich and The Mysteries of the Organism.
Wow, perfect. Favorite book?
Proust. La Recherche.
La Recherche de Tom Perdu.
Yeah.
Marvellous.
But not in French. Not in French. In English, the Scott Moncrief translation.
Okay, thank you. Favourite TV show, past, present, box set, anything?
Bar Show.
It was funny, wasn't it? I still watch it now, actually. It's very good, very good. An epiphanal moment in your life.
Oh, making the System 700 player sequence all the way through and then being able to make a fifth and a third and an octave, taking away a cassette of just a sequence apart and playing it to death in the car and for about 4 or 5 days afterwards, realized that you could make this thing do anything.
Wow, that's a great answer. By the way, did Giorgio Moroder use the System 700, didn't he, I think he did. Oh, no, it's Moog, wasn't it? No, it's Moog. Anyway, if you had an alternative career, what do you think it would have been?
Novelist.
Really? So you really like that? Have you written books that have been published?
No.
Oh, come on. Man, you'd be good at it. I just did my autobiography last year, which is rubbish. If I can do it, you can do it.
Well, I don't know. I just, I'm too lazy. I mean, no. I went to secondary school as well. This is one of the things, like, the older I get, the more, I don't know, so somehow, you know, the things that make you are the things that break you. And I know that if I had had a bit better of an education, I would have had the kind of self-discipline to sit down and write something. But that's kind of really what I wanted to do before, you know, when I was like a kid, 7, 8, wanted to be a novelist.
Oh,
didn't really write very
yeah, really write. Do it. I think you'd be good. You're obviously a highly creative, interesting guy with a there's quite a lot of
range. Oh, more, Martin, more.
No, but I'm just saying, I'm not just trying to blow smoke at your ass. I before, it's only because COVID came along that I wrote the autobiography, because I knew I was going to have a lot of time where I was going to go insane if I didn't have anything creative to do. So I thought, well, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. And I've never written anything beyond 3,000 words at a time in my life, because I didn't go to university, I didn't do any of that stuff. Yeah. And I ended up writing 130,000 words. I was doing 3,000 words a day at one point, and that's a lot. You know, and it just poured out. And of course, I over delivered in terms of numbers of words to the publisher, and thinking they were going to cut it all back. And they said, no, it's fine. They just did a few like corrections of stuff here and there. But you know, if I can do it, you can do it. I'm telling you.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. Think about it. And then when you're a famous author, I just need a little.
It's all down to the podcast I did with Martin.
It's all down to the podcast.
Check out the epiphanal moment.
That's it. That's the epiphanal moment. New epiphanal moment. What's your favorite? Who's your favorite visual artist? Or conceptual artist? No, it's tough.
It's really tough. One of Goya.
Goya
visual
art. I love Goya. Yeah.
You go to the Prado and you go into the Goya room, it's hard to come out without like just going, oh my God, that's just like unbelievable.
That was Dali's favorite artist, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yeah. I suppose the way to put it is the one that's had most influence on you. Favorite group or musician? Tough, incredibly tough question, I know. And it's not a test. I mean, you can... if you quickly ask me, it'd be different every day, you know.
Yeah, it would be different every day. And it's... I don't know. They've just been. I don't really have any taste. I was a massive fan of music, right? So, the first kind of stuff that I started, you know, getting into was the Beatles, like everybody else. By the time my balls had dropped or I'd started growing pubic hair, I was much more into the Stones, and I loved all the glam stuff.
Yeah, me too.
But I only kind of really stopped being a fan. There isn't one person, and in fact, some artists. Which I would have been happily 10 years ago, I would have gone David Bowie, for instance.
Yeah.
I now can't listen to any Bowie at all because to me he sounds now like a jigsaw man where I can kind of hear where he's got everything from.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's terrible. Maybe it's even some sort of aspect of grief.
Yeah.
And not having it anymore.
I know what you mean, David.
I cannot listen to Black Star at all. It's the one record, in fact, if I'm ever somewhere and that comes on, I will go and ask for it to be taken off or I will leave.
It's too sad.
I mean, absolutely love Leonard Cohen. I think Leonard Cohen's just a fucking was a genius. And I love his last records as much as his first. Okay. Yeah.
All right. If there was a song that you. No, wish isn't the right word, but if there's a song that you that has been an inspiration to you or a song that you wish you'd written, I don't know, maybe you don't write so much now, but so one song, there's several songs that I could name personally, but
is it okay to have people that I've worked with?
Of course it is, yeah.
Well, basically, there's the one song that's been rattling around my head for the last kind of like few weeks is a song called Disintegration by The Cure. And it's got this kind of opening line, which is, I miss the kiss of treachery. And there's Jesus and Judas in that opening line.
Yeah.
And one of the things I'm kind of really into is I'm very into lyrics.
Yeah.
Now, I know that a lot of pop music producers, are kind of not really they're not that bothered. As long as the lyric does its job, they're not kind of really that bothered. But that's my hooking. I kind of know, or my feeling for what the music should sound like or what I should feel off of it comes from the lyric, doesn't come from the notes or the music.
Interesting.
And that song is, the lyric is absolutely unbelievable.
I shall check that out because I'm not familiar with it. Okay, what's your favourite drum machine?
DMX.
Okay.
The DMX.
And finally, what's your favourite synthesizer? I think I know the answer to this. Oh, I know it's a tough one, isn't it? There's so many different ones. But
I love the MS-10.
It's beautiful. The MS-10.
Everest 20, and I was kind of like fucking about with it and the patching. I sold all my synths apart from I've got a little that one, you know, the original Mini Korg. I've still got a Mini Korg, and I love that too. Mainly because once you've got sound, it's the only thing in synthesizers is the moment you've got a sound that was any good, you should use it. If you try to make a sound, the more you try to make a sound, you get a sound, you think, oh, that's pretty cool, but I want it to be a bit more string-like. You mess about with it, and all of a sudden you haven't got a sound. Right. You might have made something a bit more string-like, but it's not as good a sound. And the Mini Korgs, the old one with the sliders, if you know that one.
Yeah.
That's, you sort of get it all in a position, you think, Christ, why is it? How is it making that noise? And you think, oh, well, if it didn't quite have that, and you just touch one thing and, oh, shit, and you can't get it back.
Yeah, I know. I love all that stuff. I mean, I've explained to it. I do a bit of education. I try and explain to the students when I'm talking about analog synthesis that the great thing about analog synthesis originally is that tiny movements can make massive impacts. It's like the butterfly effect. So whereas we're now in a hyper-rationalized one gazillion sample world where you can approximate to a lot of stuff, but tweaking it doesn't really do the job. So I love the randomness, and I think there's not enough randomness in electronic music creation at the moment. And so, yeah, that's what I think.
Well, there would be, yeah, you would be in pre being able to memorize everything, pre being able to store everything, pre all that shit. People were making snapshots of time.
That's right.
And they're not doing that. It's never a snapshot.
Yeah.
Never.
We did
any point.
There's one patch sheet for the System 100 that still exists, which I kept, which is one of Ian's patch sheets. For being boiled. Which was just the rhythm patch, but fucking awesome. Anyway, so there's this guy who does these video podcasts who's an uber geek, and he owns a lot of these instruments, and he's an expert on them all. And he said, would you mind if I recreated? Have you got the patch sheet? Because it's a bit of a thing that I put up on the internet from time to time. So I gave it to him, and he's posted a video now of his recreation of Being Boiled with the original instruments, and it sounds fucking great. And but not only that, explaining the techniques, which we weren't even really thinking about at the time. It was just like, hell, you plug this into this and this happens.
Well, doesn't it sound good when you put the cut off and back?
Yeah, and like randomizing the fucking, the lengths of the notes using the hardware sequence, all that stuff. Yeah. And he recreated it. It sounds great. And so I love all that stuff. And I think, but, you know, we used to have patch sheets for every song when we first started doing stuff with the early Human League. And it took us like a minute to change in between songs. That must have been riveting for the audience. And you'd often get it wrong.
Yeah. Let me do my sign off to you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the gig at the Nashville.
That was one of the best gigs I ever went to.
I was there the night that Bowie came down. Where according to it, he didn't have any minders. Yeah. No.
Oh, he did.
I was standing at the bar when he came in with these two absolutely enormous kind of Arthur type people, or whatever, the guy that is in Man Who Fell to Earth. That night, though, fucking hell, amazing.
Oh, thanks, mate. He actually turned up in the dressing room 10 minutes before we were due to go on stage. And I think there were about eight people came with him. It was fucking amazing. Coco was with him, his personal assistant.
Yeah.
I've got a photo of it. It's amazing. And
anyway,
David, it's been a total pleasure talking to you.
And absolutely lovely talking.
I know it's like old codgers and everything. I never thought we'd reach this point, to be honest, but we have, and we're all okay. And I hope all.
But it's like being Harry Patch, isn't it? It's like being Harry Patch. you're one of the people that survived out of the First World War, and you're here to tell people what it was like.
Yeah.
And and also keep carry on irritating them.
That's right. Love but it. I hope all the medical stuff goes fine, and we should keep in touch, mate. And great to meet up in the flesh at some point. Where are you based?
Oh, I live in Shepherd's Bush.
London. I'm in Marylebone. I might give you a bell and see if you fancy coming out for some fun at some point.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right, man. Well, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
That was Dave Allen. What a lovely guy. And a talented guy, and yet another one of those people who had no musical training, and B, found their own path, their own innovative path through towards a long-lasting and successful career. He's worked all over the world. He's worked with Connie Plank, sounds fascinating, and we learned quite a lot about that, didn't we? And I love this idea of this Frank Sinatra duets album. It's like an urban myth that he recorded a bunch of it over the telephone, and he knew nothing about it, but it's on the internet. So it must be true. Please consider supporting our Patreon site. We still need money to continue this on. It's patreon.com/electronicallyhours. It doesn't cost much, but it really makes a big difference as to whether we can afford to continue doing this. And if you just want to email me with some ideas or guest suggestions or ways to contact them, even criticisms, I'll just chuck those in the bin, though. It's electronicallymartin@gmail.com. That's Martin with a Y, of course. Another great guest for you next week. I'm really looking forward to speaking with you. Bye.
Kate Brooks. Hello, Martin. A fabulous episode with Daniel from Ladytron, who is a lovely person. We were friends about 20 years ago when he was still around the North, and he was kind enough to give me one of my first ever jobs, which was to do a remix for one of his acts. When I got my first deal, he was the person to tell me that I absolutely must spend the £150 to join PRS. I was so naive at the time, it would not have occurred to me. Crazy. Great to hear his voice again. Always very happy to listen to you talk politics, by the way. Kate, thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Kate. This is from Danny Barnes. Hello, Martin. Can I just say a big thank you? Love your show. Really great guests. I'm catching up on past shows. Pete Wiley was hilarious. Peter Hook and Stephen Morris, really interesting. Really enjoyed Stephen Melinda and Chris Watson. Fascinating. So sad you didn't get to speak to Richard Kirk. Keep up the great work. Really interesting stuff. Could I recommend Paul Haig? Yes, I would like to have Paul Haig on here. Thanks, Danny. Good.